This is Audible.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. Random House Audio presents Star Wars Kenobi by John Jackson Miller. Read for you by Jonathan Davis.
Until the time is right, disappear we will.
Yoda. Darkness has fallen on the galaxy. The Emperor has taken control of the Galactic Republic, aided by Anakin Skywalker, once one of the brightest of the Jedi Knights, charged with protecting the helpless. Having fallen to the dark side of the mystical force, Anakin lives on as the Emperor's ruthless enforcer, Darth Vader. But hope also lives in the form of Anakin's infant son, protected by Anakin's friend and former mentor, Obi-Wan Kenobi. Kenobi flees with the baby to the remote world of Tatooine, where years earlier, Anakin's fall truly began when he vengefully massacred a native clan of Tusken raiders. Unaware of that event, and still believing that he killed Anakin in their desperate duel, Kenobi settles into a new role, watching over the child and his adoptive family, the Larses, from a distance. But hiding is difficult for one accustomed to action, and even desert Tatooine has those who require the help of a Jedi.
Prologue.
It's time for you to go home, sir. While Ulbrich woke up and looked at his empty glass.
What's that, you say?
The green-skinned bartender prodded the old human on the shoulder.
I said it's time for you to go home, Master Ulbrich. You've had enough.
That ain't what I meant.
Ulbrich said, rubbing the crust from his bloodshot eyes.
You called me sir, and then master.
He leered suspiciously at the barkeep.
Are you an organic or a droid?
The bartender sighed and shrugged.
This again. I told you when you asked earlier. My eyes are large and red because I made Duros. I called you what I did because I'm polite. And I'm polite because I'm not some old moisture farmer, deranged from too many years out in the...
Because,
the white-whiskered man interrupted,
I don't do business with no droids. Droids are thieves, the lot of them.
Why would a droid steal?
To give to other droids,
Ulbrich said. He shook his head.
The bartender was clearly an idiot.
What would... the bartender started to ask. Never mind, he said instead.
He reached for a bottle and refilled the old farmer's glass.
I'm going to stop talking to you now. Drink up.
Ulbrich did exactly that. To Ulbrich's mind, there was one thing wrong with the galaxy.
People. People and droids.
Well, those were two things. But then again, wasn't it wrong to limit what was wrong with the galaxy to just one thing?
How fair was that?
That was how the old farmer's thinking tended to go. Even when he was sober. In 60 standard years of moisture farming, Ulbrich had formed one theory about life after another. but he'd spent enough of the early years working alone. Odd how not even his farmhands wanted to be around him. That all his notions had piled up, unspoken. That was what visits to town were for. Opportunities for Ulbricht to share the wisdom of a lifetime. When he wasn't getting robbed by diabolical droids pretending to be green bartenders. They weren't supposed to allow droids inside Junix's joint. That was what the ancient sign outside the Anchorhead bar said. Junix, whoever he was long since dead and buried in the sands of Tatooine, but his bar still stood. A dimly lit dive where the cigarra smoke barely covered the stink of farmers who'd been in the desert all day. Ulbricht seldom visited the place, preferring an oasis establishment closer to home. But having traveled to Anchorhead to chew out a vaporator part supplier, he'd stopped in to fill his canteen. Now, half a dozen lum ales later, Ulbricht began thinking about home. His wife was waiting for him there, and he knew he had better go. Then again, his wife was waiting for him there, and that was reason enough for him to stay. He and Magda had had a horrible fight that morning over whatever it was they'd fought about the night before. Ulbricht couldn't remember what that was now, and it pleased him. Still, he was an important man, with many underlings who would steal him blind if he was away too long. Through a haze, Ulbricht looked to the chrono on the wall. There were numbers there, and some of them were upside down. And dancing. Ulbricht scowled. He was no fan of dancing. Ears buzzing, he slid off the bar stool, intent on giving the digits a piece of his mind. That was when the floor attacked him, swiftly and scurrilously, intent on striking him in the head when he wasn't looking. It would have succeeded had the hand not caught him.
"Careful there," said the hand's owner.
Bleary-eyed, Ulbricht looked up the arm and into the hooded face of his rescuer. Blue eyes looked back at him from beneath sandy-colored eyebrows.
"I don't know you," Ulbricht said.
"Yes,"
the bearded human responded, helping the old farmer back onto the stool. Then he moved a few paces away to get the bartender's attention. The brown-cloaked man had something in his other arm. Ulbricht now saw a bundle of some kind. Alerted, Ulbricht looked around to see whether his own bundle was missing before remembering that he never had a bundle.
"This isn't a nursery,"
the bartender told the newcomer, although Ulbricht couldn't figure out why.
"I just need some directions,"
the hooded man responded. Ulbricht knew many directions. He'd lived long enough in Tatooine to visit lots of places. And while he hated most of them and would never go back, he prided himself on knowing the best shortcuts to them. Certain that his directions would be better than those provided by a droid pretending to be a Duros, Ulbricht moved to intervene. This time, he caught the railing himself. Ulbricht looked back warily at the glass on the bar.
"That drink ain't right," he said to the bartender. You're...
The newcomer interjected cautiously.
"You mean to say they're watering the ale?"
The bartender looked at the hooded guest and smirked.
"Sure, we always add the scarcest thing on Tatooine to our drinks. We rake in the credits that way." "Ain't what I mean,"
Ulbricht said, trying to focus.
"You've done slipped something in this drink to put me out, so you can take my money. I know you city types."
The bartender shook his bald head and looked behind him to his similarly hairless wife, who was washing up at the sink.
"Close it up, Yuna. We've been found out."
He looked to the hooded stranger. We've been piling customers' bodies in the back room for years, but I guess that's all over now, he said jokingly.
I won't tell a soul, the newcomer said, smiling. In exchange for directions, and a bit of blue milk if you have it.
Ulbrecht was puzzling through that exchange when the bartender's expression turned to one of concern. The old farmer turned to see several young humans entering through the arched doorway, cursing and laughing. Through his haze, Ulbrecht recognized the drunken rowdies. The two in their 20s were brother and sister Mullen and Vika Galt, Hellion spawn of Ulbrecht's greatest competitor out west, Oren Galt. And their cronies were here too. Zed Grabo, the big menace who could outlift a loader droid. And, at just a little over half his size, young Jabe Calwell, son of one of Ulbrecht's neighbors.
Get that kid out of here, the bartender yelled when he saw the teenage tag along. Like I told the other guy, the daycare's around the block.
At the reference, Ulbrecht heard catcalls from the young punks, and he noticed his savior turning to face the wall with his bundle, away from the troublemakers. Vika Galt shoved past Ulbrecht and grabbed a bottle from behind the bar. She paid the duros with an obscene gesture. Her fellow hooligans had moved on to a helpless victim, Yuna, the bartender's wife. Catching the startled Duros woman with a pile of empties on her tray, Zed spun her around for sport, causing mugs to fly in all directions. One struck the shaggy head of a patron at a nearby table. The Wookiee rose to register his towering disapproval. So did Ulbrecht, who had disliked several generations of Galts and didn't mind helping to put this generation in its place. He staggered to a table near the group and prepared to raise his objections. But the Wookiee had precedence, and Ulbrecht felt the table he was leaning against falling anyway. So he decided to check things out from the floor. He heard a scuffling sound and only vaguely registered the arrival of the bartender's wife, who scuttled into cover beside him. The Wookiee backhanded Zed, sending him across the room and into the table of some people Ulbrecht was pretty sure were thieves, even though they weren't droids. He'd eyed the green-skinned, long-snouted Rodians all afternoon and evening, wondering when they'd harass him. He knew henchmen for Jabba the Hutt when he saw them. Now, their table upended, the thugs moved, chairs overturning as they shot to their feet and reached for their guns.
No blasters!
Ulbrecht heard the bartenders yell as customers stampeded for the exit. The call didn't do a bit of good. Trapped between advancing attackers, the Galts, who had drawn their pistols when the Wookiee struck their comrade, began firing back at the Rodians. Young Jabe might have fired his weapon too, Ulbrecht saw, had the Wookiee not lifted him from the ground. The Titan held the howling boy aloft, about to hurl him into a wall. The bearded newcomer knelt beside Ulbrecht against the bar and leaned across him toward the bartender's wife.
Take care of this,
the man said, placing his bundle in her hands. Then he dashed into the fray. Ulbrecht returned his attention to the bar fight. Above him, the Wookiee threw Jabe at the wall. But somehow, boy and wall never met. As Ulbrecht craned his neck to see, Jabe's flailing body flew in an unnatural curve through the air and landed behind the bar. Stunned, Ulbrecht looked to see if Yuna had seen the same thing. But she was frozen in terror, eyes squeezed shut. Then a blaster shot struck the floor near them. She opened her eyes. With a scream, she shoved the bundle into Ulbrecht's hands and crawled away. Ulbrecht turned his own frightened eyes back to the brawl, expecting to see the Wookiee beating Jabe to a pulp. He saw, instead, the hooded man holding Jabe's blaster and pointing it at the ceiling.
The man fired once at the light globe suspended overhead. A second later, Junix's joint was in darkness. But not silence. There was the Wookiee's howl, the blaster shots, the shattered glass. And then, there was a strange humming sound, even louder than the one in Ulbrich's ears. Ulbrich feared to peer around the edge of the table shielding his body. But when he did, he could make out the silhouette of the hooded man, lit by a wash of blue light, and stray blaster bolts of orange ricocheting harmlessly into the wall. Dark figures surged forward, the criminal Rhodians, but they fell away, screaming, as the human advanced. Ulbrich slid back behind the table, trembling. When quiet finally came, all Ulbrich could hear was a gentle rustling inside the blanket on his lap. Fumbling for the utility light he carried in his pocket, Ulbrich activated it and looked down at the bundle he was holding. A tiny baby, with a wisp of blonde hair, gurgled at him.
"Hello,"
Ulbrich said, not knowing what else to say. The infant cooed. The bearded man appeared at Ulbrich's side. Lit from below by the portable light, he looked kindly and not at all fatigued by whatever he had just done. "Thank you," he said, taking the child back. Starting to rise, he paused. "Excuse me, do you know the way to the Law's homestead?" Ulbrich scratched his beard.
"Well, now, there's four or five ways to get there. Let me think of the best way to describe it."
"Never mind," the man replied. "I'll find it myself." He and the child disappeared into the darkness.
Ulbrich rose now, turning the light onto the room around him. There was no good Mullen Galt, being revived by his no-good sister as Jabe limped toward the open doorway. Ulbrich could just make out the Wookiee outside, evidently chasing after Zed. The bartender was in the back, consoling his wife. Jabba's thugs lay dead on the floor. The old farmer slumped back down again. What had happened in here? Had the stranger really taken on the Tufts alone? Ulbrich didn't remember seeing him with a weapon. And what about Jabe, who'd seemed to hang in the air before he dropped behind the bar? And what was that blasted, flashing blue light? Ulbrich shook his aching head and the room spun a little. No, truth was, he couldn't trust his besotted eyes. No one would risk his neck against Jabba's Tufts. And no one would bring a baby to a bar fight. No decent person, anyway. Certainly not some hero type.
"People are just no good," Ulbrich said to no one. Then he went to sleep. Meditation. The package is delivered. I hope you can read my thoughts, Master Qui-Gon. I haven't heard your voice since that day on Polis Massa, when Master Yoda told me I could commune with you through the Force. You'll remember that we decided I should take Anakin's son to his relatives for safekeeping. That mission is now accomplished. It feels so strange being here, at this place and in this circumstance. Years ago, we removed one child from Tatooine, thinking him to be the galaxy's greatest hope. Now I have returned one, with the same goal in mind. I hope it goes better this time, because the path to this moment has been filled with pain, for the whole galaxy, for my friends, and for me. I still can't believe the Jedi Order is gone, and the Republic, corrupted, and in the hands of Palpatine. And Anakin, corrupted as well. The hollow vids I saw of him slaughtering the Jedi younglings in the temple still haunt my dreams, and shatter my heart into pieces over and over again. But after the horror of children's deaths, a child may bring hope as well. It's as I said, the delivery is made. I'm standing on a ridge with my riding beast, a Tatooine Eopie, looking back at the Lars homestead.
Owen and Baru Lars are outside, holding the child. The last chapter is finished. A new one has begun. I'll look for a place nearby, though if I hang around too long, I half expect Owen will want me to move someplace else, farther away. There may be wisdom in that. I seem to attract trouble, even in such a remote place as this. There was some mischief yesterday at Anchorhead, and before that, some trouble in one of the spaceports I passed through. None of it was really about me, thankfully, or why I'm here. But I can't afford to react to things as Obi-Wan Kenobi anymore. I won't be able to turn on my lightsaber without screaming Jedi Knight to everyone around. Even on Tatooine, I expect someone knows what that is. So this will be it. From here on out, as long as it takes, I'm minding my own business and staying out of trouble. I can't play Jedi for this world and help save the other worlds at the same time. Isolation is the answer. The city, even a village like Anchorhead, runs at too fast a pace. Out on the periphery, though, should be another story. I can already feel time moving differently, to the rhythm of the desert. Yes, I expect things will be slower. I'll be far from anywhere and alone, with nothing but my regrets to keep me company. If only there were a place to hide from those.
Part 1. The Oasis. Chapter 1.
Everything casts two shadows. The suns had determined this at the dawn of creation. Brothers they were, until the younger son showed his true face to the tribe. It was a sin. The elder son attempted to kill his brother, as was only proper. But he failed. Burning, bleeding, the younger son pursued his sibling across the sky. The wily old star fled for the hills in safety, but it was his fate never to rest again. For the younger brother had only exposed his face. The elder had exposed his failure. And others had seen it, to their everlasting sorrow. The first sand people had watched the battle in the sky. The sons, duly covered in shame, turned their wrath on the witnesses. The Sky Brothers' gaze tore at the mortals, burning through flesh to expose their secret selves. The sand people saw their shadows on the sands of Tatooine and listened. The younger spirit urged attack. The elder told them to hide. Counsels from the condemned. The sand people were condemned as well. Always walking with the twin shadows of sacrilege and failure beside them, they would hide their faces. They would fight. They would raid. And they would run. Most sand people struck at night, when neither Sky Brother could whisper to them. A Yark preferred to hunt at dawn. The voices of the shadows were quieter then, and the settlers who infested the land could see their doom clearly. That was important. The elder son had failed by not killing his brother. A Yark would not fail, had never failed in killing settlers. The elder son would see the example and learn. Now. Tuskens! A Yark charged toward the old farmer who had given the cry. The raider's metal Gaddurfi smashed into the human's naked chin, shattering bone. A Yark surged forward, knocking the victim to the ground. The settler struggled, coughing as he tried to repeat the cry.
Tuskens!
Years earlier, other settlers had given that name to the sand people who obliterated Fort Tusken. The raiders back then had welcomed the name to their tongue. It was proof the walking parasites had nothing the sand people could not take.
but Ayark couldn't stand to hear the proud name in the mouths of the appalling creatures, and few were as ugly as the bloody settler now writhing on the sand. The human was ancient. Apart from a bandage from a recent head injury, his whitish hairs and withered flesh were exposed to the sky. It was horrible to see. Ayark plunged the hefty Gaderfi downward, its metal flanges crushing against the settler's ribcage. Bones snapped. The weapon's point went fully through, grinding against the stone surface beneath. The old settler choked his last. The Tuscan name again belonged only to the Sand People. Immediately, Ayark charged toward the low building, a short distance ahead. There was no thought to it. No predator of Tatooine ever stopped to reflect on killing. A Tuscan could be no different. To think too long was to die. The human nest was a wretched thing, something like a skeddo hive. Scum molded and shaped into a disgusting half-bulb buried in the sand. This one was formed from that false rock of theirs, the Simstone. Ayark had seen it before. Another shout. A pasty white biped with a bulging cranium appeared in the doorway of the building, brandishing a blaster rifle. Ayark discarded the Gaderfi and lunged, ripping the gun from the startled settler's hands. Ayark did not understand how a blaster rifle tore its victim apart, but understanding wasn't necessary. The thing had a use. The marauder put it to work on the settler, who had no use. Well, that wasn't exactly true. The settlers did have a use, to provide more rifles for the Tuscans to take. It might have been a funny thought, if Ayark ever laughed. But that concept was as alien as the white-skinned corpse now on the floor. So many strange things had come to live in the desert, and to die. Behind, two more raiders entered the structure. Ayark did not know them. The days of going into battle flanked by cousins were long since past. The newcomers began flipping crates in the storage area, spilling contents. More metal things. The settlers were obsessed with them. The warriors were too. But it wasn't time for that. Ayark barked at them. Ingay! Ingay! The youths didn't listen. They were not Ayark's sons. Ayark had but one son now, not quite old enough to fight. Nor did these warriors have fathers. It was the way these days. Mighty tribes had become mere war parties, their ranks constantly evolving as survivors of one melted into another. That Ayark led this raid at all bespoke their misery. No one on the attack had lived half as long as Ayark had, or seen so much. The best warriors had fallen years before. These youths certainly wouldn't live to vie for leadership. They were fools. And if Ayark did not kill them for their foolishness, they would die some other way. Not this morning, though. Ayark had chosen the target carefully. This farm was close to the jagged Jundland wastes, far from the other villages, and it had few of the vile structures by which the residents wrenched water from a sky none could own. The fewer spires, vaporators the farmers called them, the fewer settlers. Now, it would seem, there were none. Except for the young warriors fumbling, all was quiet. But Ayark, who had lived to see 40 cycles of the starry sky, was not fooled. A weapon stood beside the doorway leading outside. The old humans left by accident? Rifle to silvery mouthpiece. Ayark sniffed. No. With one swift motion, Ayark smashed the weapon against the door jamb. The rifle had been used to kill a Tuscan. The smell of sweat from another day still clung to the stock. It differed from the old human scent, and that of the white creature the settlers called a Bith. Someone else was here. But the rifle could not be used now. nor ever again.
A weapon that killed a Tusken had no more power than any other, so far as a Yark was concerned. Such superstitions were for weaker minds. But just as Tuskens prized their Banthas, the settlers seemed to prize individual rifles, etching symbols on their socks. The human that carried this one was more formidable than the old man and the Bith creature, but he would have to resort to something new and unfamiliar next time. If he survived the day, a Yark would see that he didn't. The war leader reclaimed the Gaderfi on the floor and shoved past the looting youths. Footsteps in the sand led around back, where three soulless vaporators hummed and defiled. A small hut for servicing the foul machine sat behind them. Fitting. A Yark would make the inhabitants bleed for using the vaporators. Slowly, and so the sons would see. What the settlers had stolen would return to the sand a drop at a time.
Rura! Rura!
A Yark called, straining to remember the old words.
We is here in peace.
No answer. Of course there would be none. But someone was surely inside and had heard the words. The warrior was proud of remembering them. A human sister had joined a Yark's family years ago. The Tuskens often replenished their numbers by kidnapping. The band needed reinforcements now, but would not take anyone here. The settlers' presence so near the wastes was too great an offense. They would die, and others would see, and the Jundland would be left alone. The other warriors filed from the house and surrounded the service hut. The Tuskens numbered 8. None could challenge them. Cloth-wrapped hands curled around the shaft of an ancient Gaderfi. A Yark inserted the trang, the curved end of the weapon, into the door handle. The metal door creaked open. Inside, a quivering trio of humans huddled amid spare parts for the thirst machines. A black-haired woman clutched a swaddled infant, while a brown-haired male held them both. He also held a blaster pistol. It was the owner of the busted rifle, and a Yark could tell he was missing the weapon now. Swallowing his fear, the young man looked right into a Yark's good eye.
You! Go! We're not afraid!
Settlers lie!
A Yark said. The strange words startling the humans almost as much as they startled the other Tuskens.
Settler lies.
8 Gaderfi lifted to the sky, their spear points glinting in the morning light. The Yark knew some would land true. And the old sky brother above would see again what real bravery was.
Ah, ah, ah!
The sound echoed over the horizon. As one, the war party looked north. The sound came again, louder this time. Its meaning was unmistakable. The youngest Tusken in the party said it first. Crate dragon. The warrior child spun and stumbled over his own booted feet, landing mouthpiece first in the sand. The others looked to a Yark, who turned back toward the hut. The war leader had seen enough human faces to read expressions, but even to a seasoned marauder, the visages were startling. The farmer and his wife didn't just appear relieved, they looked defiant. In the presence of a crate? The greatest predator Tatooine knew after the Tuskens? Yes, a Yark saw. And that wasn't all. The young mother was clutching something beside the baby in her free hand. A Yark barked a command to the warriors, but it was too late. With the horrific sound in the air, none would stand. The two looters from earlier nearly trampled the fallen youth as they darted away, trying to remember where they'd set their stolen goods. The others clutched their Gaderfi to their chests and fled behind the main hut.
Wrong! Wrong! That wasn't what a Yark had taught them. Not at all!
but they scattered before they even knew where the dragon was, leaving their leader alone with the settlers. The young farmer kept his blaster pointed at a yark but did not fire. Perhaps he'd calculated the risk, deciding the unfired weapon was more of a deterrent than a shot by a shaky hand. It didn't matter. If the settlers had hoped for a distraction, they had gotten one. A yark snorted and stepped backward, tan robe swirling. The warriors were running this way and that. A yark yelled, but no one could be heard over the din. There was something unnatural about the sound, but what? No one would pretend to be a crate dragon. If any could, it would never sound so mechanical. No mistaking that, a yark thought. The moan of the dragon had resolved itself into a head-splitting shrill far beyond the capacity of any lungs. It was coming loudest from a new source, immediately apparent. A horn attached to one of the silver spires in the middle of the farm. And there were similar sounds emanating from over the hills to the north and east. A yark stood in the middle of the yard, Gadurfi raised aloft.
Pradora! Pradora! Pradora!
Fake! The young looters appeared again, running over a crest back toward the farm. A yark exhaled through rotten teeth. At least someone had heard over the racket. Now at least maybe they could... blaster fire. An orange blaze enveloped one of the runners from behind. The other turned in panic, only to be incinerated as well. A yark crouched instinctively, seeking cover behind the accursed vaporator.
Wahoo!
A metallic wave, copper and green, swept over the dune. The yark recognized it right away. It was the land speeder that had haunted them before at the Toll Rock. And now, as then, several settler youths clustered in its open interior, hooting and firing wildly. A yark darted behind a second vaporator, suddenly more confident. There was no dragon, only settlers. The Tuskens could be rallied against them if they stood true. But they weren't standing. One fled toward the nothingness of the east, and a yark could see two more landspeeders racing after him. And the clumsy young warrior, who had barely survived the rites of adulthood days before, hid behind the hut, clutching at the sands in cowardice. Only the sons knew where the others had gone. No good. The first speeder circled the settlement, its riders showering fire on nothing in particular. And now, another hovercraft arrived. Fancier, with sloping curves. The silver vehicle carried two humans in an open compartment protected by a windshield. A grim, hairy-faced human steered the vessel as his older passenger stood brazenly up in his seat. A yark had seen the passenger before at a greater distance. Clean-shaven, older than most Tuskens ever got, and always wearing the same senseless expression. The smiling one.
"More to the south, folks!"
the standing human said, macro binoculars in hand.
"Keep after 'em!"
The yark didn't need to know all of the words. The meaning was clear. The missing warriors were in nearby, ready to strike. The band, routed, had taken flight. Seeing the tall human's landspeeder, the cowering young Tuscan from earlier squealed and stood. Leaving his Gadurfi on the ground, he bolted.
"Hurrak!"
a yark yelled.
"Wait!"
Too late. Another landspeeder banked, and the hollering riders aboard chopped the fleeing sand person down with blast after blast. Not 6 days a warrior, and dead in seconds. This was too much. A yark rose, weapon in hand, and dashed behind the hut. Away from where the laughing settlers, aware only of their killing, could see. Ragged fabric flew as the warrior tumbled over a dune into a dusty ravine. Another dune followed, and another. At last, a yark fell to the ground, gasping. 3 had been lost, maybe more. And the Sand People couldn't afford to lose anyone. Worse, they'd lost to settlers using a low trick no Tuscan 4 years earlier would have fallen for. The settlers would know now, the mighty Tuscans were not what they once were. Struggling to stand, a Yark looked down at the ground. The elder shadow lengthened. Like the older brother son, the band had struck and failed. It was time for the Tuscans to hide again. Chapter 2. Warren Galt towered over the farm, a lofty witness as some Tuscans ran for their lives and others ran to their deaths. Clinging to the side of the Vaporator Tower, he watched the last land speeder disappear over the horizon.
"Okay, call control, that's got it," he said into his comlink.
"Shut it down." He released the comlink button and listened. His ears still rang from the alarm atop the tower, which he had just deactivated by hand. Peering out from beneath the canvas brim of his range hat, he scanned the landscape. One by one, the sirens kilometers away went quiet, and silence returned to the desert. He looked at the comlink and cracked a grin.
"Orin, son, that's some pull you've got there."
It was nice to reach a point in life where people did what you said. And on Tatooine, where the people were born cussed and nobody took orders from anyone else, it meant even more. The danger was past. For the first time since receiving the distress signal, Orin took a deep breath and pondered the barren land below. He'd been born on a farm just like this, far from the nearest way station, nearly 50 standard years earlier. And even now, there was no place he'd rather be in the morning than on the range. People thought he was crazy for that. Everyone he'd ever met preferred the evening, with its relief from the heat. But once the suns were gone, and the air settled on you like something dead and heavy, you had to get underground. Nothing good happened after dark, with Tuscans and who knows what else on the prowl. Mornings, meanwhile, were like getting out of jail, or so Orin imagined. On Tatooine, you might overnight know better than a womp rat in a hole. But you'd become human the second you stepped outside. And then, there was that little stretch between first and second sun, when the cold night wind would kick its last and the planet itself would sigh. Good water prospectors lived for those moments, when the precious drops that had birthed in the night suddenly realized you were onto them and fled. A smart farmer, like Orin, could smell them and follow them. And it was possible to follow them, because in daylight nothing could stop you. Not in this region. Not anymore. Those were the rules. The new rules, maybe, but his rules, made possible by his hard work and guidance. "Guess I forgot to tell this batch of Tuscans," he thought, climbing down the ladder. The raiders had ruined more than the morning for these poor people. Orin winced. The guts of half a dozen maintenance and sentry droids marked the Tuscans' path into the camp. 2 vaporators sparked, maintenance doors at their bases bashed open. And then there were the strike points, scattered randomly around the yard. A couple smoked still, where blaster fire had flash-fused the sand into lightning glass. His posse had left those, not the Tuscans. Orin had never known Plug-Eye to use blasters on the way in. Plug-Eye. This raid could have been the work of no other. No other Tuscan in this part of the Jundland Wastes would dare attack at dawn. No one had ever caught more than half a glance of Plug-Eye and lived to describe it. If they'd lived, Orin always said, then they didn't meet Plug-Eye, but some other Tuscan, with a more amiable disposition. Descriptions of the notorious raider varied. Skinny or fat? Male or female? Short and stubby or a Wookiee in a robe? The tales had only two things in common. Plug Eye was fierce as fire. And where other sand people had metal turrets for their eye holes, something must have happened to one of the warrior's eyes. Rather than simply removing the eyepiece, Plug Eye had jammed a crimson stone into the opening. Or something. The stories didn't even agree on which eye it was. This time, though, things might be different. They'd arrived quickly enough to save some witnesses. Oren had already been dressed and in the fields for an hour when the call, or more correctly, the call, came. That fact and his work team's proximity had saved the Bizard family from a horrific end. But what had come before was tragic enough. Two of Oren's neighbors, cousins on his ex-wife's side of the family, exited the back door of the house carrying the body of the Bith farmhand. Oren looked down as they passed. The posse would handle the burial, just as, over the dune to the east, more volunteers were burning the dead Tuscans. They had to make this as easy for the Bizards as possible. He'd lived through it before, when his youngest had died, just as senselessly. Oren heard motion in the house.
"Mullen, you in there?" he asked.
"Yep."
Oren's older son, he couldn't bring himself to think of him as the only son yet, sauntered from the building holding two halves of a blaster rifle.
"Looks like Plug Eye was here,"
Mullen said.
"Figured."
Inscrutable behind his black goggles, Mullen Galt could have been a clone of his father at 25, if the younger man weren't trying so hard to look like someone else. Both were tall and powerfully built, with the ruddy skin of farmers born and raised. There the similarities ended. Blue-eyed Oren's hair was dark and elegantly graying. He tried to look nice even on the range. You never knew who might happen by. Mullen, meanwhile, had woken in his clothes from the previous night's carousing. That was typical. He'd sacrificed several teeth years earlier to a tangle with a gambler in Anchorhead, and he'd lost another in the same town just recently. People said that was why Mullen frowned as often as his father smiled. But Oren knew that wasn't so. The boy had been scowling in the crib. Oren took the rifle pieces. Most Tuscans wouldn't leave anything that might be useful. Plug Eye seemed pickier. How many were there? Mullen picked at his beard and stood against the doorway, scratching his back against the jamb.
"Three Tuscans dead in the yard. Then those that took off into the hills. Vika just called. She lost him up at the Roya Rift."
Mullen looked keenly at his father.
"I figured you'd want me to call off the hunt. They're on their way back."
Oren snorted.
"Well, don't miss old Pluggy too much. Next time breakfast rolls around..."
He stopped. A woman's anguished sobs echoed through the house.
"The owner.
Is she all right?"
"She's out front with the old man,"
Mullen said.
"She's pretty shook up."
"Imagine so."
Oren looked up. "Who's with her now?"
"I said, the old man."
Oren gawked.
"The dead old man?"
He threw the fragments to the ground.
"I told you to make sure someone was with her, Mullen. And you thought I meant her dead father?"
Mullen simply stared.
"Mullen, I swear!"
Oren grimaced and jabbed two fingers at the bridge of his son's goggles, clonking his son's head against the door.
"Really?"
The young man said nothing as his father marched back to the land speeder. Finding his twill half-cape behind the passenger seat, Oren draped it over his shoulders and turned to face the house. "This isn't going to be easy." The sight of dark-haired Tyler Bizard cradling the old man on the stoop took his breath away. It was grisly what the raiders had done. It had to be Plug Eye. But what chilled him more was how the young woman seemed not to care about the state of her father's body.
Without looking up, she sensed Orin's approach.
Someone's come, Daddy.
Orin took off his hat and instinctively knelt beside her. He'd known the woman when she was a child. Her father, Lotho Pelhane, had been a hand on Orin's family ranch for 20 years. Before Lotho struck out on his own, Tyla and Orin's kid used to play together. Orin placed his cloak over Tyla's shoulders. As he did, she buried her head in his chest and bawled.
I know, Tyla. I know,
he said, embracing her. It's a blasted thing, all right. He looked down at the corpse, still awkwardly slumped against her lap. Lotho Pelhane still had a weeks-old bandage around his head, a surreal sight given the mess that was made of the rest of him. Orin looked away. Tyla whimpered.
I tried to remember, Master Galt.
Orin.
I tried to remember. You sold us the alarm and the activator,
she said, showing him the remote control device in her hand. She was clutching it almost hard enough to crush it.
I was so scared,
she gasped.
I couldn't remember how to turn on the local alarm at first.
It's all right, he said. The settler's call worked just fine. We got your signal, and we came right here. Gently, Orin pulled her away from the stoop, allowing Lotho's body to almost imperceptibly slip away from her. You did just fine. Your husband and your boy are safe. We got the Tuscans.
I don't care!
She looked down at her dead father.
I don't want to stay here. Not anymore.
Orin pulled back from Tyla and brought her upright, squeezing her shoulders in his firm hands. Now listen. I knew your father. You know Lotho wouldn't want to hear this. He wasn't any more scared of Tuscans than he was of his own shadows. She looked down at the bandage on her father's head and sniffled.
They nearly got him last month, you know. Knocked him down one night at his place. It's why he came to stay with us. But he was getting better. He said he'd gotten away once, so he thought he was safe.
That's right. And you made this place safe with the call. You did the right thing. She wept again. Orin just waited. He'd been here too many times before, though less often lately. This was bad, no accounting for it. But we got a bunch of them, and we'll get the rest of them. And it'll get better. You understand? She pulled away, suddenly angry.
What do they want? They're monsters.
Tatooine's got sand, and it's got monsters, Orin said. He looked over to see Mullen standing with the burial detail. Now I'm going to check on that husband and son of yours. These folks will take care of your dad. Until we get you back to the Oasis. And Aline Cowell will put you up there tonight. Tyla nodded weakly and began walking, still oblivious to the bloody mess her tunic had become. Orin looked skeptically at his son as she went out of earshot. Can I trust you to take care of this woman for 5 minutes without sending her into another conniption? Mullen spoke in a low voice.
Sure, sure. But weren't you going to ask her about Plug Eye? You said you...
Where's my hat? Orin looked around on the ground. I need something to hit you with.
Now go!
Orin found Teleco Bizard, the young owner of the homestead, at the machine shed, surrounded by a buzz of activity. The rest of the posse had returned. The grown-ups in the group, a distinction defined more by good sense than age, had tackled, without delay, the list of things that always had to be addressed in these cases. Though the posse was officially leaderless, Orin had always been the one to take charge in the past. He was glad now to see that so much of his advice had stuck. Some folks were in the house cleaning up. Others were fixing the vaporators. Still others were gathering the goods the Bizards would want for their stay at the Pika Oasis. They were working, even knowing they were missing out on important hours in their own fields. And then there was his daughter, Vika,
and her junior satellite, Jabe Calwell, sitting on crates with a flask out, drinking under the morning suns. Aura knew it wasn't water. After all, Vika was drinking it. Since her twin brother's death, the 21-year-old had decided to do all the living he'd missed out on. And Jabe, at 16, Oren's newest farmhand, was doing his best to keep up with her. They were in the middle of describing how they'd killed one of the sand people to Teleco, who sat numbly as he bobbled his unknowing baby on his knee. The farmer's blaster sat on the sand nearby, unfired. When Vika noticed her father's approach and grim expression, she grinned awkwardly.
"Whoops. Sorry," she said, quickly passing the flask to Teleco. "Here, bunny. Drink up."
The frazzled young farmer looked blankly at the container. Oren rolled his eyes and barged in.
"Sorry is right."
He snatched the flask and threw it behind the shed. He glared at Vika. "Get these people some water. Now." Smirking, Vika ambled off, Jabe in tow. Oren sighed. His daughter had the amiable attitude that Mullen lacked, but her interest in others was a centimeter deep. Both his children had missed the empathy ship. It fell to him, as usual. Oren knelt before the young farmer and his infant. "You all right?" Teleco spoke quickly and excitedly.
"Yeah, I'm amazed you got here so fast."
"There was some luck. My hands and I were working the towers on the West Range when you activated the settler's call. We were halfway here before the folks at the Oasis even got to their speeders."
Oren knew there was luck, true, but also good design. This was how it was supposed to work. When a homestead activated the call, everyone in this part of the desert moved. If settlers were armed and had a ride, they followed the sirens to trouble. If not, they mustered at the Pika Oasis, where guns and vehicles were garaged behind Danar's claim, the area's general store. The alarm at the activating location had a different sound from the others, but all started with something calculated to spook any Tusken. The recorded howl of a crate dragon. That had been Oren's favorite touch.
"Well, it's a wonderful thing, sir. Worth every credit."
Oren smiled humbly. "Tell your friends. It's for all of us, really."
"Her dad, Lotho, never wanted to buy into it, but..."
The young man broke off and looked away. He clutched the baby tighter.
"You forget about all that,"
Oren said.
"But I want you to remember something for me, if you can. The Tuskens. What can you tell me?"
Teleco looked to him urgently.
"Oh, it was Plug Eye, all right. No mistaking it. Where the right eye was?"
"Right from where you're looking?"
Teleco pointed to his right eye.
"No, this eye. It shines."
Oren started.
"What, like a cybernetic?"
That sounded absolutely crazy.
"No, sir. More like a crystal. It caught the light when I looked, and I couldn't take my eyes off it."
He shivered in the suns.
"Scared the life out of me."
"I don't doubt it."
Oren scratched his chin.
"Anything else?"
The young farmer paused.
"The robes were different, I guess. No bandolier. But really, I was so focused on the eye."
Oren stood and patted Teleco on the back.
"Forget it, son. Now let's get you and Tyler taken care of. And Aline will put you up at the claim as long as you need."
Oren watched as the farmer and child departed. Mullen stepped to his father's side.
"Any help?"
"Nope."
Mullen sneered.
"And he had a shot at Plug Eye and didn't take it."
"I don't think that boy would know his blaster from his spanner."
Oren looked behind him and chuckled.
"Now, where's that flask?"
Vika and Jabe walked up from the house.
"I thought you didn't want me to drink this early,"
Vika said.
"You make me drink,"
Orin said. He turned to look at Jabe, fresh-faced and thrilled to be here. The boy was the age his Varan, Vika's twin, had been 5 years earlier, when tragedy struck. It was one reason Orin had taken him onto his maintenance crew. Jabe was a sunny presence. But Orin knew what awaited the kid at home.
Boy, when your mother finds out I let you go out with the posse, they'll need to make room for me on the pyre beside the Tuscans.
Vika opened the maintenance hatch on her sporty land speeder.
You want to hide back here, Runt? You'll just fit.
Jay blushed at the teasing.
It won't be that bad, he said.
Oh, yes, it will.
Orin stared at the kid. You'll be begging the Jawas to adopt you. He stepped forward and clapped his hands twice, loudly.
That's it, people. Good job here. Back to the Oasis. Drinks at Danar's claim.
Chapter 3.
The old Nikto woman plopped a bolt of cloth on the counter.
Do you work here?
Standing behind the counter, Annalene Calwell didn't look up from her datapad. No, I come in here and do inventory in my spare time. A moment passed before Annalene suddenly froze.
Wait,
she said, eyes widening as she took in her surroundings.
Counter cashbox title deed.
With a look of alarm, Annalene turned abruptly to the alabaster-skinned customer.
I'm sorry. I guess I do work here.
It was a game they'd played every day since Herbaly Napti's first visit to the store. Except that, for the Nikto woman, it wasn't a game. Herbaly had never once remembered who Annalene was. For a while, Annalene had thought the alien simply couldn't distinguish among humans. Eventually, she figured out that Herbaly just didn't care. And so their game began. That had been 11 standard years ago. The shrivel-faced alien clicked her tongue with impatience.
Now, see this?
Her withered white finger jabbed at the fabric.
Do you know why this costs so much?
No,
Annalene said, smiling primly.
Why?
The Nikto's cracked lips pursed. She started to say something more, but Annalene stopped her.
Just a second. They need me in the cantina.
Her apron whirled as Annalene spun and walked the meter and a half to where her sundries counter turned into a bar. She picked up a glass that a sleeping prospector had knocked over and then returned to Herbaly.
I'm back, she said.
The Nikto woman tapped her foot.
Is there someone else here I can talk to?
Now there, I can help you, Annalene said. After setting the glass in a basin, she stepped out through a gap in the long counter and walked to one of the back tables, where a green-snouted Rodian huddled silently over his morning calf. Annalene clapped her hand on his shoulder, an act that he seemed not to notice in the least.
This is Bomer, she said.
Herbaly studied him.
Does he work here?
We don't know,
Annalene said. But he's here an awful lot.
Thank you just the same.
The elderly Nikto sniffed disdainfully and headed for the front door. Annalene picked up the bolt of cloth from the counter and called after her.
I'll set this aside for when you're here tomorrow, Herbaly. Have a nice day.
Herbaly said nothing as she stormed past Lily Pace, Annalene's best friend, who was preparing a parcel for mailing. Another of the store's many services. The crimson-skinned Zeltron lapped heartily as the Nikto slammed the door behind her.
That's our Annie,
Lily said.
Retailer of the year. Customers can't stay away.
Sure they can, Lily.
Annalene orbited one of the luncheonette tables, cleaning it off without looking at it.
See, Danner had it figured. Anyone can stay away for a while. Until they remember that it's 30 kilometers to the nearest working keg. Then, they never want to leave.
I've noticed,
Lily said, stacking packages. That was shorter than your usual go-around with Herbaly.
Something biting you?
No. Carting the breakfast dishes behind the counter, Annalie knew that wasn't true. But what she told her friend about Danar's claim certainly was. The place was the largest facility of any kind in the Pika Oasis. Two of the domes had been there since before anyone could remember, part of some ancient farm. Annalene's late husband, Danar, had added on, connecting one of the domes with a new oblong sales area beneath a rounded roof. The dome behind now constituted her family's living quarters and guesthouse. The main building had been Annalene's domain for the majority of her 37 years, and in that time, she'd crammed an amount of commerce that defied all geometry into the limited space. Visitors encountered rows of shelves as they entered, all angled so Annalene could see down the aisles from behind her counter, which ran nearly the length of the eastern wall. But most patrons usually headed past the sundries for the rear of the main room. There, near where the far end of Annalene's counter terminated in a bar, a food preparation area sat close to 8 cramped dining tables. Every day, Annalene fed and fortified half the workers living near the oasis. Not necessarily in that order. This was her roost, but the complex went on from there. Northwest of the main store was the first garage Danar had built to service the vehicles of Oasis prospectors. It had been expanded many times since, as local mechanics rented bays. To the north and east sat a livestock area, where the few surviving animals from Annalene's father's failed ranch had formed the basis for a thriving livery, serving those daring fools who preferred the reptilian dewbacks to land speeders. And all around, the oasis, a wide clearing shielded from the wind by gently rolling sandhills. Once a basin for a prehistoric lake, the area and its clumpy soil gave rise to flowering pika plants and a few hardy deb-deb trees. And something else. Orin Galt's newfangled cylindrical vaporators rose all around, producing water for delivery in the vast tankers that sat parked outside the claim's garages. Most of the harvest was bound for faraway parts. The locals drank what they needed and little more. They knew what they had and its value. Though gifted at water prospecting, Danar had never taken much interest in moisture farming. He'd reasoned that a store would weather the bad harvest years better. And that had mostly turned out to be true. But he'd left his widow with so many secondary businesses under one roof that Annalene feared taking a day off, lest Tatooine's rural economy collapse. She'd held up okay, or so she thought every once in a while, when she caught her reflection in the glassware in the sink. Annalene could even recognize herself on occasion. The auburn hair of her youth, which she wore tied back, was going to brown, not gray. So far, so good. Inside work had never fully met with her approval, but it had kept her skin rosy rather than roasted. And Annalene's eyes were about the only true green thing on the whole planet, if you didn't count dewbacks or Rhodian barflies. Counting dewbacks was now her daughter's job anyway. Looking out the square window, Annalene could see Callie, blonde and determined, trying to teach the dewback yearling some manners before they realized they had the muscle to tear the fencing apart at will. At least, Callie wasn't messing with Snit, Annalene saw to her relief. The creature wasn't of the cannibal breed. Annalene wouldn't have let one of those near the compound. But Snit had been bitten by a creedle as a hatchling, and had been snapping at everything in sight since. Annalene assumed her daughter had the sense to stay away, but she never knew. Breaking dewbacks wasn't a safe job for an assassin droid, much less a 17-year-old girl. But Danar Calwell had never accepted limits, and his oldest child wasn't about to either. stubbornness bred true. Annalene had hoped her son Jabe would be different. But it wasn't turning out that way. And between the emergency siren, her kids, and the customers today, Annalene had just about had it. She glared out the window and winced. In pain.
Ow!
That's new, Lily said, depositing her parcel and some credits on the counter. She pointed to Annalene's hands.
You have literally cut off your own circulation with your apron strings. Appropriate.
A little on the nose, though.
Looking down, Annalene quickly unwound the fabric from her reddened palm.
You're the range psychiatrist now?
No, but I've got 5 children of my own. And I know if you keep staring at Callie and those animals, she's just gonna try to ride the crazy one.
Annalene turned away from the window.
Now that's where you're wrong, she said, collecting the money. It's always the kid I can't see that I'm worried about.
Jabe had already been long gone with the prospectors when the settlers' call had sounded. Her son knew very well that Annalene thought about him getting anywhere near Oren's business. But as far as she could tell, the boy didn't care at all. She just didn't understand him anymore. Jabe had something everyone on Tatooine dreamed of. A guaranteed life of safe indoor work, filling his father's shoes. Instead, the stubborn teen kept sneaking away with Oren's work crew. Sure, Annalene knew the boy had eyes for Oren's daughter, Vika. But he had no more chance with that hellion than he had of becoming Chancellor of the Republic, or whatever they called it these days. No, Annalene concluded. He'd gone with the crew this morning in retaliation for having been made to clean the cookers before dawn. And if he followed them into danger, that'd be spite too. That irritated her beyond measure. Spite was stupid. Even Callie was too smart to ride snit just to make a point. And Annalene had always figured Jabe had sense, her sense. He'd give the Tuskins the same berth, wouldn't he? She was afraid she knew the answer. She found her inventory data pad and returned to staring at it. She couldn't read a word, of course. She only saw Jabe. And Oren. Oren. The claim had thrived long after Danar's death because Annalene had one steadfast rule. She never let anyone have anything on account. There was only one exception. Oren. Danar's best friend and sometimes business partner. Oren and Danar's friendship had gone back years, long before Annalene had come to work at Danar's store as a teenager. The two men had so many side deals that she'd always felt awkward trying to set limits. But Oren was sorely testing her patience now, dangling the possibility of range work for her son. Oren's family was a mess. Why did he meddle with hers? Aggravated, she tried to focus again on the data pad.
You're holding it upside down,
Lily said from behind. Annalene didn't look up.
Are you still here?
I'm waiting for my change.
You're out of luck.
Change is the one thing Tatooine doesn't have. Taking a deep breath, she looked back at Lily and smiled wanly.
How much was it?
Lily waved her hand.
Keep it. Maybe you can pay Dr. Mel to give you something to help you relax.
Yeah,
Annalene said. Like a ticket to Alderaan. As if Lily's words had summoned him, the local physician, a Mon Calamari man, popped his head in the side door.